We left off at verse 13, verse 13 of chapter 1. We did a whole bunch of verses last time. We're going to do a few fewer this time. We never get too far ahead. We've got some people out. There's also some big concepts we're going to nail down today. So that's page 1466 in the Pew Bibles, starting at verse 13. Now I would not have you ignorant, brethren, that oftentimes I purposed to come unto you, but was let hitherto, that I might have some fruit among you also, even as among other Gentiles. So he starts off the verse by this kind of double negative. Now I would not have you ignorant of what I was attempting to do. There's a certain amount of hesitancy in this. There's a caution and care with which Paul talks to the church in Rome. He doesn't run over them or tell them they're stupid or don't know anything. One reason is because Paul is always very careful not to try to sow seed in a place where someone else has been. So much of Paul's missionary journeys are as a pioneer. Right? He goes to places where the gospel has not been preached. And so he doesn't want to come across as someone who's tilling where another man has sown. But he still says he wants to go and visit them. Right? And there's a good reason for that. He says that, there's actually a couple of reasons. One, he says, is to have some fruit among you as among other Gentiles. So if you think of him, again, that sort of agricultural reference as a sower and seeds coming up. The church at this point in Rome is not very big, obviously. It's anywhere from kind of as small as like 30 or 40, is theoretically possible. Or, you know, all the way up to numbers are tough, a couple hundred, 300. It's not gigantic. And Rome at this point has about 1 million people in it, right? Rome is a huge city at this period of time, right? It's hard to imagine that would be that big, but yeah, about 1 million folks in Rome and kind of in the suburbs of it. So Paul is going to them because there's a lot more to harvest. So he sees himself as going to them to assist them in bringing more fruit into the church. So that's one of his goals, he states, that he's going there. He's not saying that they're doing it poorly, but of course, he's the one who goes and brings people in. He's the chief evangelist of the Gentiles. And that's really his second motivation here. He's been given this charge, right? He's been given this responsibility to bring the gospel to all of the peoples of the world, right? All of the Gentile groups, Greeks and barbarians, wise and foolish. When we think of Greeks and barbarians, what are we thinking of there? The whole barbarian thing, why do we call them barbarians? Well, it kind of comes from the way the Greeks talked about how everyone else spoke. So basically, to be civilized, you spoke Greek. And that was what to be a civilized person was. And the barbarians, essentially, they all sort of like, it's basically a play on words. It's sort of like, bar, 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 bar. Like they're sort of like the people talking gibberish, right? The uncultured, that word kind of becomes barbarian, is sort of the term that comes out of it. So a barbarian is everybody who's not Greek is a barbarian, which is kind of a fun way of thinking about things. But Paul has gone to all of them. Right? Because remember, by this point also, you know, even people who aren't ethnically Greek speak Greek. Greek is the lingua franca of this period. Latin, of course, the official language of the Roman Empire, but you're much more likely to be able to communicate in Greek. One thinks, for example, when Pontius Pilate writes over the cross of Christ, he writes it in Latin, the official sort of administrative language of the Roman Empire. Greek, the language most people would have spoken and all over. And in Hebrew, interestingly. Not Aramaic. He writes it in Hebrew, which is an interesting choice, which is, again, kind of the official ecclesiastical language of the Jews. Even though most people couldn't speak Hebrew, which is why they misinterpret Jesus when he starts Psalm 22, my God has forsaken me. They misinterpret what he's saying. They think because they can't speak Hebrew. That's why by the time Jesus is crucified in the Second Temple period, there's all these things they call targums, which are sort of translations of the Hebrew, the sort of a kind of commentaries on the Hebrew so people can kind of understand it. Aramaic has a lot of similarities to Hebrew. If you've ever looked at Aramaic and Hebrew, there are a lot of similarities, but the differences are enough that it is not a one-to-one thing. But Paul has this mission to go out and bring the gospel to all the Gentiles. And until he's finished this mission, he feels he's in debt to the world. Right? Not that the world owes him something, that these are his people all out there. And that's why he kind of goes like the Terminator across the ancient world, just getting beat up and shipwrecked and just jailed. And doesn't matter. He's just going to keep going until you kill him. The only way you're going to stop him is to kill him. And even then, he's a victor. That is his motivation to go everywhere all the time and bring the gospel. You can't stop him unless you're going to kill him. So that's why he says, I'm a debtor both to the Greeks and to the barbarians, this is verse 14, both to the wise and the unwise. So as much as in me, as I am ready to preach the gospel to you that are in Rome also. Right? So he's coming. Now, he's been stymied. That's what that means in 13, where but was let hitherto, means he couldn't get there. There's all these reasons he's been unable to get there. What those reasons are, it's interesting, as the sort of argument develops within the epistle. Is it God keeping him from Rome? Is it Satan keeping him from Rome? Is it both? Eventually, he will get there. And you could make an argument that Luke's Acts of the Apostles is the story of how the gospel gets to Rome. That's one way the book has been described. It's a really interesting thing when you think about it. How the gospel moves from Jerusalem to the capital of the empire. Because, of course, how does Acts end? It ends with Paul in Rome. Right? Now, he goes there. It's a fascinating way, of course. But he's there, and he's preaching. He's brought the gospel, and people are believing and joining. So he is going to get there. It's just going to take a while. Verse 16. For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. So we need to think about this concept of shame and ashamed. Right, when Paul talks about this. I think there's a bunch of words in here, ashamed and salvation, Jew first, Greek. There's a bunch of words in here to kind of figure out, because they're going to be all used all over the rest of this letter. One way of looking at this whole verse, and something that kind of is in the background of the entire presentation Paul's giving to these Romans, is it kind of like how King Herod sort of looms over the beginning of the gospel. The Roman emperor kind of looms large in this whole telling to the Romans. And that was such a big part of life in Rome, was the sort of governmental business. You might think about this in the same way people who live in and around Washington, D.C. are intimately connected to stuff that's going on with the government all the time, right? It's their whole lives. Even if like the way that they live is based somehow connected to that, and it greatly affects them. The same is kind of the living in Rome. We think of like bread and circuses even, like just the way in which the Roman Empire governed itself and administered its people. The emperor is there. And so Caesar, as we talked about in our introduction, Caesar saw himself as kind of the lord of the world, right? A quasi-religious lord of the world, but also just the master of this gigantic empire. And so, again, it is very much a position that is imperiled, or at least a position that is challenged and threatened by this Jewish Messiah, right? It's one reason why Herod is so mad when the wise men said that there was a new king of the Jews, because he's the king of the Jews. Right? And again, he was called king of the Jews as kind of sort of a, an emperor is a king of kings. That's what an emperor means. And so the emperor let Herod call himself the king of the Jews and gave him that title as kind of a thing to get him out of his court. Like, Herod shows up and petitions to be the leader, and Herod is kind of annoying and also kind of vile. And Augustus just says, ah, get out of here. You can be the king of the Jews. It's kind of a nominal position, right? Because there's already going to be a governor there, too, to kind of report back on what they're doing. And, of course, Caesar Augustus is still going to be emperor, the king of the kings. So with that said, this idea of a lord of the world challenges that in a big way. And again, there's a treasonous aspect to the preaching of this gospel in Rome. Right? That the actual Lord of the world is the one who sits at the right hand of the Father and governs all things from heaven. Right? That's the actual Lord of the world and not Caesar. And Paul, of course, is determined not to shrink from this great calling he has, not to be ashamed of it. So he's not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. And we should hear an echo of Mark chapter 8, verse 38, where Jesus says, "Whosoever therefore shall be ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him also shall the Son of Man be ashamed, when he cometh in the glory of his Father with the holy angels." So to be ashamed of Christ, to be ashamed of him in this time, is to be a traitor. Is to be a traitor, right? And it's madness on top of everything else, but it is to be a traitor. It's to betray Jesus, but also it's to be a traitor to good itself, which is coming. Right? If you could imagine, think of of Quisling, right? Think of, what was he? Is he Norwegian? He one of the Scandinavians, anyway. But he was a traitor to his people because he assumed that, of course, the opposing army would never be defeated, the occupying army would never be defeated until one day it is. And next thing you know, you're caught there as a gigantic traitor to your own people. There are many examples of this. It's not an accident that in the center of Dante's Inferno, the people who are around the devil are those who are the betrayers, the traitors. So the devil holds in one hand Judas and Brutus, right? Brutus, of course, who betrayed Caesar and stabbed him, and Judas, of course, who betrayed Christ. And again, the idea being that, like, the worst possible sin, like, because remember, there's all these various sins that surround, as you work your way down to hell. All of them terrible in all their various ways. The most horrible one is betrayal. And there's a truth in that, right? To be a traitor. And that's the sense of this idea here. And we see that in we'll talk about what shame means here. But what we have to start off with by saying is that Paul is not kind of a stupid or silly or unserious person who doesn't know he's in danger. Paul knows he's desperately and incredibly in danger all the time, both from his own people who are trying, or his own ethnic and religious kinsfolk who are trying to kill him because they don't believe in the Messiah. Really, in many ways, he has a new religious kinfolk, and in some sense, this gets complicated because is it a new religious kinfolk? I mean, for Paul, he's never left the religion. He's in the same religion, right? It's those that don't believe in the Messiah who have formed a new religion. He's in continuity with the religion that's come through because Christ is the fulfillment of it all. So if the fulfillment comes and you refuse to believe in the fulfillment, you're the one who's created a new religion, not Paul, and not the church in the world. But Paul's not ashamed of the gospel because the gospel itself has power, right? What does he say here? "For I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation." So it's not that it merely possesses power or is kind of accompanying power, but that the gospel itself is powerful, right? And he outlined what that was in verses 3 through 4, you know, concerning his son, Jesus Christ, our Lord, who was made of the seed of David according to the flesh, and declared to be the Son of God with power, according to the Spirit of holiness by the resurrection from the dead. His sort of quick and dirty presentation of the gospel. That gospel itself, that good news, has power. There's good news that the one God, right, has through Jesus Christ, crucified and risen Jesus Christ, has declared himself master of the world, right? And that through Christ, the sins of men are forgiven. We are saved by his cross and justified by his resurrection. That very claim, that good news, has the power in and of itself. And a power in and of itself that is greater than the empire, right? Because again, this isn't just silliness. Paul has seen this gospel change people again and again and again and again, right? He says in 1 Corinthians 2, "And my speech and my preaching was not with enticing words of man's wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith should not stand in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God." Right? The gospel itself is a power that changes people. And interestingly, it changes people in a way that is fundamentally different than anything else can change a person. That the Word of God regenerates people. Right? That gospel message creates the faith that saves. And so just the proclamation of it has incredible power. Because if every thing in this universe, every fallen thing has shown itself to be of less significance than the Christ who rises from the dead, but all of it is now subservient to that Christ, right? And the gospel is the proclamation that God has come and that he's shown his righteousness and love in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, which then changes everything else. That becomes the number one priority of all knowledge and humanity. Now, Paul puts this in a way that it's kind of a way of invoking the Psalms, because, again, so much of the way Paul thinks and talks, and this is true of a lot of the New Testament, is in the universe of the Psalms. This is why it's such an important thing for Christians to stay in the Psalms and constantly be reading the Psalms, because the Psalms are a microcosm of the entire Bible. And the Psalms are a way in which the New Testament thinks and works a lot of the time. I mean, the most quoted parts of the Old Testament are the Psalms in the New Testament. And there's a sense of that here, where Paul is working through an idea we find in Psalm 71. "In thee, O Lord, do I put my trust. Let me never be ashamed. Deliver me in thy righteousness." Right? I put my trust in the Lord so that I'm not ashamed. But what does ashamed mean in the Psalms? And subsequently, what does it mean for Paul? This is a military idea, right? The idea being that to be shamed in combat is to have your armies lose. And of course, that happens in the Psalms when God turns his back on his sinful, rebelling people. And so what Paul is saying here in this is that, like King David, he can trust in God. God has won the victory. And since the great victory over evil has already been won at the cross, then there's no longer a need to feel shame. There's no longer any reason to be scared that we're going to lose the battle, because the battle has already been won. So when we talk about not being ashamed of the gospel, I'm not ashamed in my own life to talk about the gospel with people. We should not think, well, that just means that I shouldn't be embarrassed or something. No, the idea here is that I'm here to declare a great victory that's been won, and that I am excited to tell the good news of that victory to every single person I meet. Because the shame of losing, the shame of being embarrassed, is nothing compared to the glory that's found in telling everybody I can find about this victory that Christ has won. And that motivates Paul to do that in places where he's going to be jailed and beaten and murdered. And it should motivate all Christians and everywhere wherever they are to share that victory, that good news with every single person they meet. Because that victory has already been won. There's no adversary we can face who wish we should be ashamed or scary. Like, fear is gone as well. Because fear and shame are very much interconnected, right? You're afraid you're going to lose a battle. You're ashamed your forces are weak. There's none of that. That's all gone because of the victory Christ has already won. And so much of getting past the lies of this world is continuously focusing on that death of shame and the death of fear in the victory of Christ, the victory which is ours. And what is that victory for, he tells us? Unto salvation. It is the power of God unto salvation. Well, what do we mean by salvation here? Is a question we should ask. I think a lot of times when we look at salvation, we tend to think of it kind of with a preconceived notion of kind of salvation being sort of post-death bliss in heaven forever. Is the way I think a lot of people would define salvation. But that's not really the sense of this at all. Death is a defeated foe. That's 100% the case. Right? A glorious part of the good news of the gospel is that death is a defeated foe at the feet of the risen Lord. 100%, right? But another big part of this is it's a rescue not just from kind of the present evil or a rescue from my fear of my future death, and that's 100% the thing that's part of this, but that's not all of it. It's the rescue from destruction, and it's a rescue for something, right? We're being rescued for a purpose, not just to sort of float around in ephemeral mist forever thinking happy thoughts. No, we're being saved. The salvation is, you know, again, the analog is the liberation from Egypt. We're being saved from sin and death for a purpose, to flourish and save the world. Because that very much is Israel's mission when they leave Egypt. You're going to go out and you're going to worship the true God and save the world. That was the mission. And that is still the mission, fulfilled perfectly in the great Israelite, in the prophet, priest, and king Jesus. And then us, who are the fulfillment of that mission, continue to move on, fulfilling that mission as the church in church militant, and then at the end of time, for all eternity in the universe. Because when we start reading about salvation in this letter, basically chapters 5-8, how does that climax? What is the climax of chapter 8? It's not just my own little personal salvation, which is important and good, right? Very good not to be damned forever. How does it climax? It climaxes into this vision of the entire creation being saved through the sons and through the sons of righteousness. So it's not just about my own personal salvation, which is a way in which this can kind of be myopically focused, is on me getting saved, which is super important. Don't get me wrong. But it is not the climax of it. The climax of this is the creation itself being saved from me, through me, by Christ, right? And that is an incredible vision, right? And changes the way we think about eternity, which is really important. And a big part of what Paul is going to be getting at. And we want to hear that rather than a lot of really bad folk religion that gets sort of pumped around. Everything from when you die, you become an angel, when you die, you get your harp and there's just all sorts of silly things people believe about the life to come, because they're focused on trying to think about heaven, and heaven is an important thing, but it is not the end of everything. It is a staging ground for the life to come, for eternity. And then finally, Paul walks us through this concept to the Jew first and also to the Greek. To the Jew first and then also to the Greek. So first off, what does he mean by Greek? Is it just Jews and Greeks that are saved? No, thank God. I don't know, do you have any Greek in them in here? You're going to be Greek in you? Well, you do by the way Paul writes this. Because in Jewish thought, there's essentially Jews and everybody else, right? So you're, the Greek here means everybody who's not ethnically Jewish, right? This makes a lot of sense in our own mind. If we remember what Jesus said, that he'd come for the lost sheep of the house of Israel, right? So the beginning of the mission of Messiah's mission is specifically the primacy that is to ethnic Israel. Now you get, interestingly, of course, inbreakings of the Gentiles, right? So for example, when the wise men showing up, right, is this foreshadowing of what's coming, right? The Gentiles are being led, are being brought by the Holy Spirit, right? You get the same thing with the centurion, right? Where Jesus says, I haven't seen greater faith than in this pagan, right? This heathen. It becomes much, much more conspicuous at Joppa and within the Acts of the Apostles. But even when Jesus is in his earthly ministry, you've got these inbreakings of this that you know is happening. When the men from Bethsaida go up to Philip and said, "Sir, we would see Jesus," and Jesus goes, "Yep, this is it. This is how I know I'm about to die." Because of course, why? Because this is the fulfillment. The Gentiles are coming, right? And the Gentiles coming is a sign of the end of the world, right? The latter days have come. So that's how, and that of course makes sense of why then Paul is selected to be the apostle of the Gentiles after Jesus' death. So that marks the fulfillment of the mission first to the Jews, and then now the Gentiles are being brought into the people of God. And through all of this, of course, you see the same pattern when Paul, as a missionary, goes to cities. Where does he go first? He would go to the synagogue first, and then he would go to the marketplace, right? So he goes to the Jews first, and then to the Gentiles, and brings them all in. Right? And of course, each one of those audiences reacted differently to this. You get the same when, again, this all over the Acts of the Apostles, this same progression of how this works. But again, the Jew and Gentile coming together is to form this new commonwealth, this new nation, this new temple, this new people, right? And so it makes perfect sense that that is the way in which this is developing. But to deny that, to deny the Messiah, is to put oneself outside of this people. Because what is the marker of what makes you part of the people of God? It is not ethnicity, it's not the wool of the flesh, it's not blood. All those things that John lists in his prologue that says aren't the things that are what mark you as people of God, it's belief, it's faith. We'll talk next time about what we mean by faith in verse 17, because it's a huge thing we have to talk about. What does Paul mean by this? Why is he quoting Habakkuk? Habakkuk's moment to shine is the next verse. A lot of people don't get real deep into Habakkuk, but you're going to get some Habakkuk next time we meet, because that's, of course, what he's quoting from. But faith is that marker of who we are, right? And that has huge ramifications for the way that people live. Think about how Paul rebukes Peter in Galatians about eating with Gentiles, right? If the mark of being the people of God is now faith, Paul looks at Peter and says, "How dare you not eat with Gentiles?" Because you got to remember, you weren't allowed to eat with Gentiles because you become unclean, right? If you were still following the ceremonial law of the Old Testament, which marked you as part of the people of God. But since you're no longer the way in which you're marked the people of God, it's by faith, Paul looks at Peter and says, you are a hypocrite for saying that the Gentiles can now be brought in, but you won't eat with them, right? Because table fellowship, being part of one family, the family eats together, right? And that's why that seems like, well, why does Paul care who Peter eats with? That seems kind of not that serious. It is serious, right? Because if you're saying, because again, what is the primary thing we do as the culmination of our service? Eat a meal, right? You're going to eat, you know, you're going to eat from the same loaf and drink from the same cup, right? Which is why you lose all that when you don't have a common cup and you don't have the same loaf. You lose the very vision of this whole thing that started from the beginning. But yeah, if but that's a thing you do together because you're all one body of Christ. And it's all interconnected into the way the Messiah is saving us. And what all that means. And you lose all that, even sometimes accidentally, just when you try to do different things. Well, sure, everyone did this forever. What if we do something different? Well, you've broken the continuity with the original symbol, which is never a good idea. It happens all the time. So, that said, we'll talk about next time about verse 17, about what this whole, how the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. But hold on this week, especially, to this very important idea of not being ashamed of the gospel. That again, it's not like getting a red face or feeling I've got butterflies in my stomach or some nonsense. It is about you have the opposite of defeat in your life. You have victory in your life, the victory of Christ. And so you should boldly proclaim that to everyone you know whenever opportunity arises. All right, thank you, everyone. That's all for today.